The Tom Woods Show, episode 2212.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you enjoy the Tom Woods Show, it's time to go to the next level. And next level, Tom Woods, is libertyclassroom.com. This is where my friends and I teach all the stuff you did not get in your conventional education, history, economics, and more, the way it ought to be taught, with all the content they left out or distorted. Check it out at libertyclassroom.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. Jeff Deist is with us again today. Jeff is president of the Mises Institute. He was the very last chief of staff for then-Congressman Ron Paul. And he has a brand new article out. Jeff, what is the... I'd never heard of this journal before. What's the journal?
This is the Journal of Ethics and Politics, Etica e Politica, because it is in Italian. So they publish both in Italian and English. It is the University of Trieste in Italy.
Ah, that's what it is. Okay, I don't keep up with my Italian academic journals, but you have a fantastic article called Evolution or Corruption, the Imposition of Political Language in the West Today. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/2212. You know, incidentally, just last night, because last week I watched Frankenstein, the 1931 original, and it was very interesting. I mean, it was much better than I thought it would be. So then I decided I got to watch the other two that have Boris Karloff in them. And the next one, chronologically, is Bride of Frankenstein. We watched that last night, and I'll tell you something. I'm talking about the manipulation of language. That woman is not Frankenstein's bride. If they never get married and there's no prospect of them getting married, then I was absolutely duped by movie executives into watching Bride of Frankenstein. I'll just leave it there, you know? So it was happening in the 30s.
Well, yeah, language has always been a tool. Let's just say it. Let's just put it that way. It's always been a tool.
Yeah. Did you ever see it? Did you ever see the original Frankenstein?
I have seen a variety of Boris Karloff movies in the past, but I don't recall having this sort of existential disappointment, Tom.
Well, the thing is, I'm on a Karloff kick lately. Just today, I watched an old interview he gave in 1963. So many years later, reflecting on being Frankenstein. And he is so charming and so articulate. And he's so thrilled. He's not in any way... He was not typecast, thankfully for him. And he's not resentful that over 30 years later, people are still asking him about this role. He says, what more could I ask for as an actor? That look, over 30 years later, you're still asking me about this role. Just an absolutely charming person. And it just goes to show, I know this isn't directly related to our subject, but you know, you get a glimpse into the culture of yesteryear through YouTube. You know, if you use it the right way and you watch these old interviews, nobody dresses or acts or speaks or conducts himself the way a guy, just a common, you know, well-known actor like Boris Karloff. He had no arrogance, no cultural edginess to prove that he was cooler than you. There's just none of that.
Well, one thing you notice about interviews from people, let's say mid-century and earlier, is the diction. Far more clipped.
Oh, yeah.
A lot more responsive. A lot more understandable. It's clear that we have had some word inflation along with our monetary inflation.
Yes. I mean, even that he would almost without a thought describe the monster as, quote, inarticulate. Now, of course, we know in the novel the monster is not inarticulate, but in the movie he is. But just to use that word, I mean, I can't imagine any Hollywood actor using just casually and unplanned using the word inarticulate. Anyway, we're going to talk about language, though, today in ways that are a little bit more... that have more, let's say, lasting significance for how we live and how we think. So you start off, actually, very early on, if I may comment on something that you might have thought of as almost a throwaway line, you were talking about the way language evolves over time. And in a very macro sense, you can see that in the evolution of Latin into the Romance languages. Because Latin, of course, strictly speaking, there are some churchmen nowadays who can still use it, but by and large, it's not really used in society. And you quote Pope Francis as contemptuously describing Latin as a dead language. And what I find so interesting about that is that that used to be an argument in favor of using it in the liturgy, precisely because it's not in the process of evolving. You don't have to worry that the meanings of sacred ideas are going to change because the language is changing. The language is not changing. That's why you want to use it. And not to mention, even as recently as Pope John the 23rd, who was canonized by Pope Francis, despite there being no devotion to Pope John the 23rd anywhere in the world, which is usually a condition for canonization. Nobody was praying to John the 23rd. Everybody forgot about him. He was the pope who called Vatican II. He said that it was important for the church to have a language that was non-vernacular. So Francis is actually at war, not just with a small sliver of his faithful, but basically with virtually all of his predecessors. And that doesn't make him pause to reflect at all, because he's a revolutionary, and the fact that he's against his predecessors is a virtue for him. I know this isn't your point, but it struck me.
There are dead languages. There are also a lot of dead popes. And someday he too shall be a dead pope, and perhaps we'll listen to him less then. But you have to understand, Latin itself was a tool of the Roman Empire. Thousands of years ago, as the Roman Empire ground its way through what we now call most of Europe, Latin was imposed, or we might say superimposed, over all kinds of, you know, I'm sure long vanished local dialects. So Latin itself was very much a tool of empire at one point. And that's a point that I tangentially make in this paper, is that, you know, we're no longer arguing over English. English is basically the default language in the world. Even in Asia, that's somewhat true today. You're very fortunate if you're born as a native English speaker, because you can go travel virtually anywhere and enjoy the privilege of speaking English or reading roadsides in English or whatever it might be, conversing, you know, transacting business. But nowadays, we're not arguing over English itself so much as whose English or which English. And that's something that interests me very much.
You used George Orwell's concept of, quote, meaningless words. I've heard you talk about this before. It is interesting how prophetic Orwell was about the way the word fascism was, well, of course, it was being used this way in his own day, but I don't think he realized just how long that would go on, that the word fascism is more or less a substitute for something we dislike. And he says that there are certain words that have been obscured, whose traditional meanings have been obscured in, quote, consciously dishonest ways, so that they serve basically an agenda rather than serve the more mundane purpose we would have for them, which is to facilitate communication of ideas from one person to another. So fascism is a great example. Also, democracy. I just wrote something about this for my newsletter audience about the word democracy. You can't possibly, how can these people possibly believe in democracy in the standard, you know, customary sense of the word, when there have been major democratic movements like Brexit, as you mentioned in your paper, that are democratic in the sense that more people voted for them than against them, and yet they still have to somehow claim this is anti-democratic. What does this mean?
Well, Brexit's hilarious, and I wanted to bring that up because it had very high voter turnout. Not everyone realizes this. It was close to 80%, and it won by a pretty comfortable 3-point margin. So I don't know what's undemocratic about that, other than the wrong people won. But what we have to understand about Orwell is, first of all, he really knew what propaganda was, because he had worked for the British government during World War II, countering Nazi propaganda with English propaganda. And he did this work in India, as a matter of fact. But also, what's so remarkable about him, and this essay, I really love it. I recommend it to people, Politics in the English Language. You can find it easily online. And it's very short, just a few thousand words, published in 1946. So he's writing right in the teeth of World War II. And even then, he's saying that fascism has become this meaningless buzzword to serve as a proxy for any kind of authoritarian government, anything bad that we don't like in governance. And of course, at the time, he had two very real examples of outright fascism in Italy and Germany, where we could all sort of get together and say, okay, we have a reasonably agreed upon definition of what constitutes fascism. You know, you can go with Mussolini's definition, you can go with the great Paul Gottfried's understanding, but, you know, you have an authoritarian leader, you have a dilution of political and press freedoms, you have a melding of corporate and state power. You know, there are a variety of elements. But let's just say, Tom, that in the 1940s, people were using fascist as a term a bit more precisely than they're using it today. And even back then, Orwell was saying, oh my gosh, you guys, you're using these words so generally that they become meaningless, and they become basically a bludgeon, a tool for the speaker or the writer to just push a certain viewpoint. And we see that in so many ways today. But fascist as a term, I talk about a little bit in the paper with respect to both the Brexiteers, who somehow, against all odds, you know, I guess because Brexit was somewhat nationalist in tenor, that nationalism and fascism are now conflated in the minds of a lot of people in the West. And then, of course, Trump, the Trump phenomenon. I mean, we have seen fascist applied to him so many times. It's just almost unbelievable. And it's never applied to, how about Barack Obama, who melded state and corporate power with Obamacare, which basically forced everyone to go out there and purchase or deal with ostensibly free market health insurance. What about George W. Bush and the Patriot Act and TSA and DHS, which created an absolute melding of surveillance, military industrial complex type private interests with the state itself? I mean, was Donald Trump any more or less fascist than a host of recent presidents? Absolutely not. You know, come on. And as we see, he probably suffered more press pushback than any president since Nixon. The press hated his guts quite openly. So if the press were afraid of Donald Trump as a fascist, they did a pretty good job of hiding it. So, yeah, I mean, we have to understand, I think, Orwell's framework for a lot of what's happening now.
I just saw, I think it was a tweet from Media Matters, which is a left-wing media watchdog group. Talk about an unnecessary institution, but there it is. And they were saying that we can get a glimpse into the fascism of the new Italian prime minister by these two facts. And so one is she's anti the LGBT lobby. So that makes you a fascist if you're against the LGBT lobby. There are some LGBT people who are against the LGBT lobby. Right? So now you have to actually favor a pressure group that's trying to bring about coercion in order to be against fascism. Okay. And then she's against recent, you know, modern gender theory, which I would say a majority of the world is against, if you were to poll them. And that also shows that she's fascist. This is quite a compendiously broad definition of fascism now.
Well, it also includes anyone who's against open immigration or more restrictionist on immigration than the current policy in Italy or America or anywhere else. So I think immigration, xenophobia, nativism, nationalism, again, these things are very different. They all ought to have precise definitions. We ought to use them in ways that are actually intended to create communication and understanding amongst us rather than using them as weapons to beat each other over the head. But I don't think what's happening linguistically, especially in America, is natural particularly. I think it's being imposed from the top down by people like the Modern Language Association and the Associated Press and Reuters and Merriam-Webster Dictionary and academics and politicians. I don't think this using Z and Zer is something that the marketplace for language, if we could draw that analogy, would have come up with. So it's fraught. We're living in fraught times. And I think people ought to spend a little more time recognizing and thinking about language as a battlefield because it's a big one. And, you know, if you listen to Noam Chomsky and other linguists, professors of linguistics, they will tell you that all of our cognition is rooted in how we learn language from a very early age. So if you can control or influence that process of language development, you can profoundly change society. I mean, language is, other than food, air, and water, our need for communication is right up there. And so if you take even a field of study with its own language, like music or mathematics, which uses numbers. The very concepts of music and mathematics, like what is a scale, what's a note, what is a point on a graph, even these concepts, which are expressed using musical notes or using mathematical equations, nonetheless, we conceptualize them using English, those of us who were born with English as a first language. That's how we conceptualize everything through language. Everything that comes in through our sensory perception, we translate into language. We say that is a butterfly. You know, we don't just have gibberish coming into our minds as a result of our senses. We translate our visual things, for example, into words. So words are at the core of our beings. Language is at the core of our beings. And so when really, in my opinion, bad people are battling it out in academic settings or at the AP to try to shape our language, we ought to pay more attention to that. We ought to be cognizant of it.
Let's take a word I don't think you mentioned in your paper, but it's a word whose definition, at least among the elites, has begun to change. That's the word violence. Now, to any normal person, you know violence when you see it, right? Somebody gets kicked in the teeth. That's violence. Somebody gives a speech saying, the reason that this particular racial group is not doing as well as this one is not because of job discrimination. And we can just prove that this is the case. Whatever the explanation is, that ain't it. That's violence. That's become violence. So that's violence, but actual violence outside your window. That's rage. That's righteous rage. So how, obviously you can't, you know, you and I have talked about national divorce. How do you inhabit the same physical space of somebody when you don't even inhabit the same linguistic or moral or conceptual universe with them?
Well, that's entirely correct. And if we don't have precise meanings and widely agreed upon meanings for words, then it's awfully hard to conduct either social or physical sciences, for example. Look at epistemology. Look at philosophy. All of our truth claims are based on words and concepts. And if those words and concepts are not agreed upon, then we are effectively all postmodernists on some sort of shifting sand. If we don't know what a yard is, or a cubic inch, or what gravity is, if we don't know what these things are, if they aren't measurable and definable in the physical sciences, then we're in big trouble there too when we're trying to build a bridge or make sure an airplane doesn't fall out of the sky. So while it sounds like this is all just about, let's say, the new LGBT trans lexicon, or this is sort of just political correctness in its next embodiment, and that woke is sort of, again, one of Orwell's meaningless words, but this time defined by people on the right. There's more going on than that. This is a real battle for hearts and minds. And so when we redefine violence into something other than what we all grew up with in the dictionary, that creates real problems for ordering a society, for having any sort of social cohesion. And, you know, we have seen, as I discuss, this, I think, very purposeful shift from use of the term equality to the term equity. This is now something that has become a staple on the left. And Kamala Harris used it throughout her vice presidential campaign out there on the campaign trail. She kept going back to equity. And so equity has a very different meaning than what most of us grew up with, you know, thinking, well, you know, equality under the law, and we all get the same rights under the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. We're all equal, and equality is a good thing. Well, equity is something very different. And Kamala Harris was quite explicit about this, talking about how, well, you know, equality is not good enough because we all start out at different places in life. And so equity means we all end up with the same amount. And that's a pretty radical shift in language. And so when you hear equity, 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 you'll see that on social media. You'll see that from NGOs and nonprofits. You'll see it from politicians. You'll see it from the media class. It's like a drumbeat. And that is designed, that is intended to basically drive the word equality out, replace it with equity, which is not just a different shade of meaning. Equity basically goes to the idea that any different outcomes in life, in terms of people's happiness or wealth or achievement or education, whatever, any sort of unequal outcomes in and of themselves are proof positive of evil, of intentional discrimination or harm aimed at certain groups or identities. You know, equity, that word, just the use of that term as opposed to equality, has embedded in it a whole host of assumptions and presumptions, which I would argue are not true, or at least not proven. And yet, when you use equity, when you fall by the wayside and just sort of go along to get along and start using the new vernacular, you accept implicitly this whole host of assumptions and presumptions. And we're all guilty of this. I mean, look at when people started saying African-American instead of Black. Well, that, you know, contains a bunch of embedded assumptions And there's plenty of Black folks who aren't real, even today, real comfortable with African-American because of what it means. And it's this sort of othering and this setting aside of a particular group of people. And so, believe you me, when you hear the term equity, whether that's used consciously or even worse, increasingly subconsciously, that's just the new term. Wow, that's a shift. And that didn't take a law. That didn't take anybody to be threatened with jail or not yet, anyway. That's just a top-down imposition of language from what I guess we could call our cultural or political or linguistic elites. And that bothers me. And I think we ought to push back.
Incidentally, for people who are interested in seeing that thesis challenged, namely that if this outcome occurs and it's unequal, then there must have been some deliberate systemic wickedness afoot that needs to be rooted out somehow through some revolutionary means, I recommend Thomas Sowell's book, Discrimination and Disparities, because as usual, it's extremely thorough and it tells you the opposite of what you would think based on what you hear repeated all the time. Let's say a word for F.A. Hayek on this. Now, because sometimes there are things where I feel like Hayek could have been stronger. But in his absolute, resolute insistence that the term social justice has to be dismissed, it cannot be used. You cannot employ the term social justice because all it leads to is confusion. He couldn't have been more right about this. And unfortunately, I run into some traditionalists, either Catholics or just generally right-wing traditionalists who feel like, oh, you Enlightenment liberals, yeah, of course you don't want to use the term social justice, but you know, the left actually is right about this because there are social injustices. All right. Well, first of all, justice is of its very nature, it's an individual thing. If there's no person who wronged you, then you really, really got to explain to me what's going on here. So I've heard some libertarians say, oh, well, we can talk about social justice because, for instance, the drug war seems to have a disproportionate negative effect on certain communities, and that's a social injustice. But my answer to that is that's a state injustice. Just say it. Mm-hmm. How is it improving things to use this weasel term social injustice? Well, you can just say what's happening. Just call it a state injustice. So in that case, it's not one individual perpetrating an injustice. It's an institution, but it's an institution that we can name. We'll just name the state and say the state shouldn't do that anymore. But in general, the social justice thing has just enabled sloppy thinking that further enables the whole left-wing agenda.
Well, today, social justice is simply a term used to denote the current left-wing political agenda. Right? I mean, that social justice is what we want if we're left progressive. So Hayek was prescient, like Orwell. The second volume of his three-volume Law, Legislation, and Liberty, he titled The Mirage of Social Justice. And of course, at the time in the 1970s, Hayek was speaking more about economic or material concerns when it came to inequality. The focus back then was more on the economics, who's got more stuff, nicer houses, all that, better education, better healthcare, and who has less and worse. So it was very much social justice when Hayek was writing his book was very much an economic concept. Whereas today, of course, social justice is a far broader identity concept. You can be the Obamas and still be victims, still be oppressed because you're Black. And so it doesn't matter that you happen to be wealthy or that you happen to have been president of the United States, you know, social justice still needs to bend your way. And I think the beauty of this is that Hayek was unstinting here. He said, no. Justice has to be temporal. It has to be individualized. It has to be specific. And any attempt to make it otherwise has to, by necessity, create injustice. Because you have to treat people differently. You have to take from one and give to another. It's zero-sum thinking, so to speak. So I like Hayek's usage here. I thought it was worth including in the paper as a concept. And we see appeals to social justice now are just the norm. We see them all over the place. We see them in the 2020 Biden campaign. It's just become, again, a buzzword or a catch-all for a laundry list of things that the left want. And more importantly, perhaps, it can never be satisfied. It can never be reached. It can never be defined. That's what progressivism is. It is an insatiable beast. And Hayek was right on. I know sometimes people think, well, he was better as an economist and not as good as a political or social theorist. But I think law, legislation, and liberty is an impressive work.
Hey, folks, quick message from Moel Woods here. If you are looking to add Bitcoin to your retirement account and thinking about the long haul, then the best and easiest way to do that is with BitTrust IRA. BitTrust IRA helps you seamlessly and securely add cryptocurrency to your portfolio. It stores your private keys in nuclear bunkers with military-grade encryption. They have a 24/7 trading platform with no minimum investments and unlimited trades, plus a team to help guide you along the way if you have any questions. They also offer the lowest trading fees in the industry. I've often said that if Bitcoin is ever to gain more widespread acceptance, it's going to have to be more user-friendly, and BitTrust IRA could not be easier to use. So go to bittrustira.com/woods today to learn more. And for a limited time, BitTrust IRA is waiving the sign-up fee for Tom Woods Show listeners, a $50 value. That's bittrustira.com/woods, bittrustira.com/woods. I don't want to spend that much time on racism because it's just who has the energy to do this? And I've covered it so many times, but the way the definition of racism has evolved over time is really an excellent example of what you're talking about. Because if somebody had asked you, let's say in 1970, what is racism? You would have said, well, it involves a, you know, let's say a knee-jerk kind of prejudice against somebody because of the race he belongs to, you know, something like that. And a hatred toward a group on the basis of belonging to that group. Everybody would have accepted that. Now we've gotten to this point that you quote the U.S. Anti-Defamation League as saying this, that racism is the marginalization and or oppression of people of color based on a socially constructed racial hierarchy that privileges white people. Mm. Okay, so in other words, if you don't believe there is a socially constructed racial hierarchy that privileges white people, I don't know where that puts you in this definition, but I guess it means you're part of the problem.
Yeah, well, it's a form of question begging, I assume. Well, who says that there's this form of hierarchy? I don't say so.
If there were, wouldn't you think that when you go to apply to colleges, that when it comes down to the time to where you're supposed to identify your race, everybody would put white, wouldn't they? I mean, if you live in a white supremacist society that benefits white people, wouldn't all black people want to put white on that application? And yet none of them do.
When you begin to code words with meaning beyond what most of us would agree is their original or dictionary meaning, you get into this kind of imposition of language aimed at political change. So look, the ADL is the ADL. They can say what they want, but Merriam-Webster did this too. You know, the people we sort of think are officially monitoring our language, the dictionary folks of all people, they gave in to Black Lives Matter and changed the definition. So now they call it the systemic oppression of racial groups, the social, economic, and political advantage of another. Well, that's not what racism is. Racism, as you alluded to earlier, is the hatred of a particular race to the extent races exist. It's kind of tough to define, but nonetheless, it's hatred of a particular race or a belief that a particular race is inherently inferior. That's it. That's what racism is. It's not Charles Murray pointing out, you know, dysfunction in some majority black city. Okay? So if we don't have an agreed upon definition, you start to get into terms like systemic. Well, then all of a sudden, not only is the language coded, but it's loaded too. That's talk about a loaded term. I mean, systemic means that it's inescapable. It's all around us. It's in the system. So it's like a goldfish swimming in water. The water is systemic. It's inescapable. So what that means is that when it comes to racism, it doesn't matter what you think or who you are as an individual. It's impossible for you as a white guy, let's say, to escape this because it's part of the system and you benefit from the system, the system, the system. So it takes away any sort of individual moral agency. It takes away the ability of individuals to simply be good humans to one another. And it basically taints an entire group of people, a racial group, if you will, with guilt. And because it's systemic, that means that something has to be smashed or upended. Well, okay, but racism is effectively a personal sin. It's a sin of the heart. In my opinion, it's not something that can be legislated away. And so we really see this. And systemic has got to be one of the worst buzzwords in popular parlance today because you hear it constantly. And folks, not only is it bad for the poor, hapless white guy, truck driver, MAGA Trumper, who's just trying to make a living while, you know, his big rig costs $250 to fill up. It's not just him you're hurting by saying it's systemic and somehow he, as a struggling truck driver, is part of this huge racial problem in America. You know, he's basically a slave owner. So it's not just bad for him. It's infantilizing for Black people as well. To basically say, well, you know, you're devoid of any agency and you're a victim of this system. And this includes Barack Obama. He too grew up in this racist system. And that's why when he was the first Black president, he got so much more grief than any white president would have got. You know, it's just endless. And so one thing the left loves to do is load terms in a way that they cannot be overcome. Either empirically, you know, say, okay, look, folks, America's not very racist. I think we should kind of stop focusing on this and just let people be. Now we accept people of all colors just fine. You know, that can never be said, basically. So it's perfect for the progressive mindset because it means perpetual revolution, this perpetual undoing of whatever it is that's systemic around us. We have to crush this system. And it's awfully easy to be worn down and worn out by this and sort of give in to the new linguistic demands. And I'm trying hard not to.
Well, ultimately, what's the pithy answer to somebody who says, if they're playing word games, who really cares? You know, I care about my taxes. I care about this, that, or the other thing. But words, I mean, what really is the significance of language being used in funny ways? We can just dismiss it. Well, why does it matter?
Well, ask your architect or the guy mixing the cement for the foundation of your house. What's a foot? What's a cubic yard? I mean, it seems to me it matters there. And so when you get over into the social science end of things, if you start to say, well, what is racism? What is justice? What is equality? What is equity? I mean, if these terms don't have reasonably precise and reasonably agreed upon definitions, then again, we're in postmodernist never, never land, where it's like an Alice in Wonderland. Words mean exactly what I say, nothing more and nothing less. Well, bully for you, but what that shows to me is bad faith. Because look, as we've pointed out today, language is a tool. It's a tool for communication between people, but it's also an institution in society, like money, like government, like churches, like schools, whatever it might be. Language is an institution in society, and institutions are in trouble right now. I would argue institutions are corrupted right now. But because language can't be owned by anyone, it's too broad. It's like culture. Nobody can own it. We know what it is, but nobody can own it because nobody owns it because there's no front door to Language Inc. like there is for Harvard. You know, if Harvard is screwing over Asian applicants, we have sort of a focus. There's a there, the Harvard admissions department. You know, so they probably have a Twitter feed. There's probably some human beings who work there or an 800 number or something. There's something tangible to say, well, I'm angry at the Harvard admissions process because they're screwing over Asians. But when it comes to language, this is so diffuse. There's so many organizations from nonprofits to academia, professors at universities, to the aforementioned, the APs and the Reuters of the world, to the MLAs, the Chicago Manual. I mean, it's so diffuse across culture. And then just the social media people voluntarily starting to use goofy things like Z or Zer. There's no sort of front door. There's no head-on opponent to fight. So this, unlike racism, in my opinion, this really is systemic and it's all around us and we ought to be cognizant of it and push back where we can.
Well, the article is available up on the show notes page for the Tom Wood Show. So it's tomwoods.com/2212. So you can check it out for yourself and discuss it because it is very much worth discussing. Hence this very episode. Thank you very much, Jeff. And thank you to all you good listeners.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.